Please be seated. Irony, very simply put, is a difference between expectations and reality. It's ironic that the time the highways become a parking lot is called rush hour. It's ironic that the doctor who is supposed to alleviate your suffering is named Dr. Payne. It's ironic that a country that wants to call itself a Christian nation refuses entry to those seeking the very same blessings we believe are blessings from God. Let's start with scripture. The scripture that we read this morning, you have to know a little bit about the background. The background is that Solomon was dedicating the temple that he has built. Now, you need to understand this about the temple. The temple was not just a worship place. The temple was understood to be the dwelling place of God, the actual home of God in that temple. So as they dedicate this temple, this dwelling place of God, Solomon offers up a prayer. And his prayer goes like this: "O God of Israel, there is no God like you in heaven or earth for keeping covenant and steadfast love with your people. When a foreigner who is not of your people comes from a distant land because of your name, hearing of your great power, hearing of your great mercy, hearing of your blessings, when a foreigner comes because of those things and prays to you, you hear and do according to all that the foreigner asks you, so that all of the peoples of earth may know your name, as we do." So the idea here is that, God, you are powerful and mighty. You bestow blessings upon us. And when people hear about our faith and our great God that we worship, they too will want to come and be a part of that. Now, you might think, well, that's great, but that's 2,000 years ago. Well, let's move it forward a little bit to what we just sang. You're the God of this city. You're the King of these people. You're the Lord of this nation. You're the light in the darkness, the hope to the hopeless, peace to the restless. You are. There is no one like our God. And greater things have yet to come, and greater things are still to be done in this place. The great irony is that some of us want to keep all of those promises and all of those blessings for ourselves. I promised that this morning we won't debate walls or visas or raids or quotas. We will talk about the importance of bringing our faith and values to bear on this topic of immigration so that we can speak and act with integrity. And I'm going to honor that practice, that promise this morning, and I'm going to offer you 8 things. This is not an exhaustive list, but I'm going to offer you 8 things that you can do when you walk out of here today that will allow you to speak and act with integrity around immigration, that will bring your faith into the equation. It doesn't matter what side you're on. It doesn't matter if you've become disheartened and think that you can't make a difference. It doesn't matter if you do all 8 or only 1 or several, but do something from this list. Number 1, humble yourself. The first thing we have to do is to admit that most of what we have is an accident of birth. I'm not saying that you should not consider yourself blessed. I'm not saying that you shouldn't be patriotic or glad to live in the United States of America. I am saying be thoughtful about your understanding of your blessings. Don't fall into the fallacy of greater deservedness. Don't refuse to consider that your understanding of your blessings might imply that others are not blessed. Don't fail to consider that your understanding of your chosenness might imply that others are not chosen. Don't refuse to investigate those things. Warren Buffett, who's a billionaire investor, puts it this way. When he talks, especially when he talks to students who are heading out into the world, he tells them this scenario. He says, it's 24 hours before your birth, and a genie appears to you. And the genie tells you that you can set all the rules for the world that you're about to enter. You can set the economic, social, political rules, all of it. Sounds great, right? But you know, there must be a catch. So what's the catch, they ask him, and this is what he says. Before you enter the world, before you are born, you will pick one ball from a barrel of 6.8 billion balls, approximately the number of people on the planet, and that ball will determine your gender, race, nationality, natural abilities, health, whether you are born rich or poor, sick or able-bodied, brilliant or below average, American or Zimbabwean. This, Buffett says, is what is called the ovarian lottery. You're going to get one ball out of there. And that, he said, is the most important thing that's ever going to happen to you in your life. Humble yourself. Number two, mark yourself a safe place. Just like you would mark yourself safe in a disaster, mark yourself a safe place for those who are one deportation away from disaster. Post signs. If you're really serious, post them in Spanish. Let people know you are a safe place, that no human beings are illegal, that love is love. I had an occasion to be part of being marked as a safe place. In December of last year, my daughter contacted me and she said, you know, Mom, I'm a math teacher. And I said, yes, I know. She said, but you were an English teacher. Yes. And I need to write a letter, so you need to help me. I said, that's fine. I can write a letter in my sleep. Tell me what it's supposed to say. Well, she said, it's supposed to say that my student, that her father should not be deported. So we started the exercise, and that's really kind of what it was, an exercise. I said, give me these facts. I need to know this information. And together we wrote the letter, and it says, I have learned that my student's father may soon be deported. And I'm writing this letter to share my belief that having her father taken from their home will have a tremendous negative impact, not only on her ability to continue her education successfully, but also on her emotional and possibly her physical well-being. I'm concerned that if her father is removed from the home, his absence will impact her tremendously. She is the youngest of four siblings, and the three older siblings have all graduated from high school. I have no doubt that the stability and guidance provided by their father is a big reason that the older siblings successfully completed high school. The stability that he provides to the family can't be underestimated. If he is taken away from the home, any number of negative things can and likely will happen. For one thing, his removal will mean that the majority of the family's income will go with him. If her mother has to replace the missing income by increasing her work hours, my student will have less supervision and support at home. It is likely that she would also have to get a job because it would take both her and her mother's income to replace her father's income. Removing her father and his support, both emotional and financial, can lead to shelter and food insecurity. Both of these will negatively impact her school performance and, more importantly, can contribute to feelings of shame about her situation and her father's deportation. All of these things make her vulnerable to depression. I urge you to keep her father here and keep her family intact. Not only will she be the better for it, but ultimately our community will be stronger because of her success. I can write a letter in my sleep, but what happened when we wrote this one is that she became real. Not a theory about her having to get a job at 16, not for the heck of it, but to support the family. Not a theory about the possibility of food insecurity, housing, shelter insecurity. Not a theory about depression. Not a theory about the shame of having one of your parents declared illegal and taken away in handcuffs. He won his case. And she is now talking about the future, and she is far from depressed, and her attendance improved, and her attitude improved, and she thinks she wants to go to cosmetology school. Mark yourself a safe place, and let numbers become people to you. Number three, learn your history. The sad truth about immigration in the United States is with very few changes, we could repeat some of the news articles and some of the political speeches and some of the op-eds that were written years ago during World War II. Just changing tiny words here and there will tell you, we can't let everyone come in who wants to come in. What will that do to our economy? Yes, people are not safe, but we want to continue to be safe here with very little change. So what I ask is that we learn our history, and before we condemn people to going back to their homelands, let's read up. Let's see what the history of the United States is in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in other countries from whom we do not want to receive immigrants. Number four, know the scriptures. If you find scriptures that suggest to you that we do not have any obligation, any Christian obligation to immigrants, please share them with me. I have not found them. I do know that in the book of Leviticus, it says, "The strangers who sojourn with you shall be to you as the natives among you, and you shall love them as yourself, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt." I do know that God said, do not deprive the immigrant or the fatherless of justice or take the cloak of the widow as a pledge. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt and the Lord your God redeemed you from there. That is why I command you to do this. And why Rabbi Jesus said, I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. Number five, admit the complexity of this and other issues and prioritize for yourself what you want to attend to. I'm going to give you a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek example about this, but this is the kind of thing that freezes me up. Many years ago now, the Presbyterian Church, of which I was a part, decided that they were going to boycott Taco Bell. They were going to boycott Taco Bell because the people who were picking the tomatoes for Taco Bell were being paid basically no wages, slave wages. They were living in inhumane conditions. And so the Presbyterian Church said we should boycott Taco Bell. Well, here's my first world problem. We lived 500 yards from a Taco Bell. And when I wasn't feeling like cooking or things got out off my schedule and I needed some fast food, I could just walk to Taco Bell, or I could get on my bike at the very least. My other commitment, though, had been to the environment. My other commitment had been to not jumping in my car every time I thought I wanted something and putting more emissions into the air. But the next closest fast food place was 4 miles away. So what was I really going to do? Was I going to jump in my car and put all the poisonous gas in the air and ruin the environment? Or was I going to go to Taco Bell? Now that's tongue in cheek. But when we get serious about our issues and what's important to us, things start to come into conflict with each other. So I'm asking you to take a look at what is truly important to you and to prioritize those things and then to vote in a way that matches your priorities. And I'm also asking you to remember that there will be no candidate who will perfectly match what your priorities are, but go with one that you can live with and then keep working. Our responsibility does not end when we vote. In the meantime, sometimes we need to practice a little bit of what people call civil disobedience. But let me just share one thing about civil disobedience. Sister Anne Montgomery had this to say: civil disobedience is traditionally the breaking of a civil law to obey a higher law, sometimes with the hope of changing the unjust civil law. But, this is the big part, but we should speak of such actions as divine obedience rather than civil disobedience. The term disobedience is not appropriate because any law that does not protect and enhance human life is no real law. Number 6, pray. I just couldn't let the opportunity go by without sharing something that my friend Darrell Watkins, who was one of your preachers while I was on sabbatical, shared in his Facebook post about prayer. I'm not going to tell you to pray for this or pray for that. I'm just going to tell you about prayer, according to my friend Darrell. He says, I am by upbringing, culture, choice, education, and occupation a person of faith. Prayer is part of my life. It's part of who I am. I believe in its efficacy. It isn't magic. It isn't a guarantee. And it isn't something one other person in the world has to embrace. But for me, prayer is comforting, energizing, and it helps with focus. If I didn't believe in a higher power, I would still pray. That's how important it is to me. Prayer is intention, which leads to attitudinal and, when it works best, behavioral changes. It sets things in motion. It, at least on occasion, seems to tip the scales, and at very least, it is an expression of hope and often of love. If prayer isn't for you, I won't ask you to do it. But I am always bothered, he says, when my prayers, whether silent, spoken, or written, receive a snarky response, i.e., prayer isn't enough. Prayer is never all I do, though there have been times when it was the best I could do. But it is an important part of how I live my life. Prayer. Number 7, own your faith. Listen carefully. Thomas Bandy says, Christians fail to make intentional connections between faith sharing and beneficial action. And they do so at their own jeopardy. Christians believe that actions will speak louder than words. Yet in our world, in which do-gooders are regarded with remarkable suspicion, Christians have to share the motivation that lies behind their actions. We as people of faith cannot let others own the words, own the dialogue, own the message. We too can speak from our faith. Some people feel very uncomfortable talking about their faith in the political arena, around issues like immigration, reproductive rights. Let me share with you this quote from William Sloan Coffin. When asked to explain when he would stop being political from the pulpit, William Sloan Coffin responded, "When politicians stop making decisions that affect the lives of those for whom Jesus died." Let's hear that again. When asked to explain when he would stop being political from the pulpit, William Sloan Coffin responded, "When politicians stop making decisions that affect the lives of those for whom Jesus died." Number 8, know that you are blessed, and to what purpose? In the opening verses of the 12th chapter of Genesis, God tells Abraham, "Leave your country, leave your people, leave your father's household, and go to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you." Abraham went, and God blessed Abraham for generations. But that's not the whole story. You have to know the rest of the sentence. God said, "I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you so that you will be a blessing, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." Perhaps one of the greatest ironies of immigration, of faith, of everything, is that we've forgotten what it means to be blessed. To be blessed is not to have money, cars, real estate, material possessions. There is nothing wrong with those, but those are not the blessings. Here are the blessings. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure in heart. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sakes. And blessed are you when people revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Here's the greatest irony. We think that blessings are about us. Blessings are about God. God who makes it to shine and to rain on the just and the unjust. We're going to end today by singing these words again. And this time we're going to sing it as though we believe it, as though it has stakes, and as though if we are truly living out this belief, people will want to come. And we're going to sing it as though when they come, we will say, welcome.